Coming up, Kim Lawton on the Christians of Jordan, where they say Christianity began. Their numbers are dropping dramatically.
How can we imagine a Middle East without Christians?
Plus, the ethics of whistleblowing. Lucky Severson examines the case of Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden broke the law. I mean, he violated his oath of office.
When your government is wrong, you need to stand up and challenge that.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. A second round of Syria peace talks got underway in Geneva this week, but they were immediately bogged down in bitterness and disagreements. Meanwhile, in Syria, continuing violence disrupted humanitarian efforts to rescue civilians and deliver food to besieged areas. Faith-based groups were among those providing emergency relief to evacuees who were described as being emaciated. More than 6 million Syrians are displaced inside that country, and another 2 million have fled to neighboring countries, among them Jordan. In Washington, President Obama expressed enormous frustration with the situation and urged more access for aid. Jordan's King Abdullah is in the U.S. this week for a series of high-level talks about the Syria crisis and the Middle East peace process. Jordan is located between Syria and Israel and is predominantly Muslim. It has long had a vibrant Christian presence, although the number of Christians there and throughout the Middle East has been going down dramatically. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, was in Jordan last month and reports today on the situation for Jordan's Christians, who insist that they be seen as part of the Holy Land.
On Sunday morning at the Orthodox Church of the Presentation of the Lord in Amman, Jordan, it's standing room only. But don't let the crowds deceive you. Christians are no more than 6% in this nation of more than 6 million. Still, they don't want to be called a minority.
We are not a minority. We are small in number. We insist that we are not a minority. We were here before Islam. We are the children of this land.
Most of the Christians here trace their heritage to the earliest days of Christianity, when Jesus ministered in this region and then his disciples established the new faith in the surrounding areas. While Christian pilgrims from the outside often refer to Israel and the West Bank as the Holy Land, several important Bible stories took place on the east side of the Jordan River, in what is now the nation of Jordan. Jordanian Christians insist they should be considered part of the Holy Land as well.
The Jordan was not the border. Archaeology, religion do not have borders. So this is the center of the Holy Land indeed.
Some of the most important sites here are by the Jordan River, where the Bible says the prophet Elijah was taken into heaven and where John the Baptist baptized Jesus. Excavations in the area began in 1996 after Jordan had signed a peace treaty with Israel and removed landmines from the area. Archaeologists unearth a cave where some say John the Baptist may have lived, as well as ruins of ancient churches, some dating back to the 4th century. Rustam Mikjian is assistant director of the Baptism Site Commission.
Depending on the Bible, depending on the pilgrims' accounts and the archaeological discoveries, we know this is the spot where Jesus baptized and Christianity started.
In the Bible story, after his baptism, Jesus began his public ministry. So Christians here say this is where Christianity really began.
This is one of the holiest three sites for Christians on earth. Bethlehem, where Jesus was born. Here, where Christianity started. And Jerusalem, the end of life. So the entire circle wouldn't be complete without these three sites.
Father Nabil Haddad is a priest in the ancient Melkite Catholic Church and says he shares a birthplace with the prophet Elijah. He says Christians are proud of their legacy here.
We are the ones who inherited this birthplace of Christianity. I think we are agents to carry this as witnesses to the whole world.
For centuries, Jordan's Christian community has played a prominent role in society.
Their social influence is certainly well beyond their numbers. Very major influence in the fields of education, in the medical field, operating some of the best hospitals in the country. They also have made a significant contribution in fields of agriculture.
Daryl Beiler is executive director of the Center for Justice and Peacemaking at Eastern Mennonite University in Virginia. He spent the last 6 years in Jordan with Mennonite Central Committee, where he worked with local Christians.
Their institutions are there to serve other Christians, but also Muslims and others in the country. So they make their services available, and they see that as their way of giving witness to the light of Christ.
Bishop Benedict, the Greek Orthodox Bishop of Amman, says serving others is how Christians here live out their faith.
And especially in our doctrine in Orthodox Church, the most important thing is love. And love, you see, we can't talk about love because love needs practice.
That impulse has been particularly evident in the Syrian refugee crisis. Almost 600,000 refugees from neighboring Syria have ended up in Jordan, generating a massive humanitarian crisis. The Christian community has played a key role in the response.
Those people became uprooted, and they have no place. But, of course, today Jordan is taking the biggest number of refugees. And this is our moral duty as Christians in the country, to be there, to support them, to make them feel as much as possible at home.
I was just very much inspired, especially in this more recent dealing with the Syrian refugees that are flooding into Jordan, the way that the Christian community stepped up to the plate. They really saw this as an opportunity to make a statement to our Muslim neighbors that we are here for you. And they stepped up to the plate in a big way.
Many Christian leaders here say they have good relations with Jordan's King Abdullah and members of his royal family.
We were lucky to see that His Majesty King Abdullah has used what I called the interfaith diplomacy. So that interfaith dialogue became part of the Jordanian diplomacy.
Compared to other predominantly Muslim countries, Christians here have much freedom of religion.
They are free to meet, to worship, to provide services, to run schools and hospitals. The line is at the point of you are not allowed to try to convert a Muslim to Christianity. There is more conversation about that, that because it is okay in those societies for Christians to convert to Islam, that there should be the reciprocal. And those conversations are happening. When that will actually change as a policy or as a practice, I don't know.
Jordanian Christians and Muslims have generally lived together in peace, but some Christians are concerned about rising Islamic extremism in other parts of the Middle East. They worry their community could be threatened if that takes hold here.
Because of the problems which happened in Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all this area, you see, they send the fanatism to this area.
Beiler says relations for Christians in Jordan have also been complicated by politics and the foreign policy decisions of the U.S. and other Western countries.
They are perceived by Muslim communities as being connected to the Western Church. And in the West is viewed as having just imposed several wars on the region, and those wars are sometimes viewed as anti-Muslim campaigns. And so the Christians in Jordan and the Middle East bear that burden of being identified with that.
At the same time, Christians in Jordan say many in the West aren't even aware that they are here.
Many Western pilgrims come to see the holy sites, and traditionally it's spoken of in the region as they come to see the old stones, but we're the living stones. We are the modern day embodiment of Christ, and people don't even know that we exist here. So there is that frustration.
But according to many Jordanian Christians, their biggest challenge is making sure their existence continues. Amid economic and political instability in the region, numerous Christians have chosen to emigrate. In addition, Christians have significantly lower birth rates than local Muslims. Consequently, as is the case in many parts of the region, their numbers have diminished significantly in recent years.
How can we imagine a Middle East without Christians?
At the Jordanian Interfaith Coexistence Research Center, Father Haddad says all faiths must work together to maintain a strong presence for the other.
This region has always had the three religions. This is the birthplace of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. So it is part of the history, it's part of the presence, and it's the responsibility of the Christians and the Muslims to work together to protect this history and the value in it.
That's the only way, he says, to ensure the future of this holy land. I'm Kim Lawton in Jordan.
The Middle East peace process will be on the agenda when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits the president at the White House on March 3rd. The administration announced the meeting this week, saying the two leaders will also discuss the Syria crisis and relations with Iran. In other news, religious leaders in the Central African Republic issued new calls for an end to the widespread sectarian violence plaguing that country. Two leading religious figures from the nation's capital of Bangui, an archbishop and an imam, have been traveling the country together, pleading for Christians and Muslims to cease the retaliatory killings that have displaced nearly a million people. The UN and other groups have warned that the conflict has caused a serious food crisis that could get much worse. Family members of Kenneth Bay, an American Christian missionary who has been jailed in North Korea for almost a year and a half, renewed calls for his freedom. Bay was arrested in November 2012 after leading a tour group into North Korea. The North Korean government has accused him of plotting to bring down the state, but his family claims he's innocent. Bay has been transferred to a hard labor camp, and this week, North Korea withdrew an invitation to a U.S. envoy to discuss his release. We have a Lucky Severson story today on the ethics of whistleblowing. Edward Snowden leaked a vast amount of data revealing the extent of the National Security Agency's surveillance around the world and in this country. Was he right to make that public, or wrong because he endangered national security? As Snowden remains in Moscow to avoid prosecution in the U.S., debate continues over the morality of what he and other whistleblowers have done.
I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong.
So is Edward Snowden a saint or a sinner, or any of the multitude of labels people have used to describe him?
No, I don't think Mr. Snowden was a patriot.
Was what he did right or wrong?
No, Edward Snowden broke the law. I mean, he violated his oath of office. His job was to protect the national interest. His job was not to define the national interest.
They see this as an ethical, moral decision, and they take a step in the direction of blowing the whistle.
I don't think anybody takes an act and says to themselves, what I'm doing is immoral, but I'm going to do it. People always rationalize.
Matthew Aid has authored two books about spying and the NSA.
I know for a fact that there has been immense damage to the ability of the National Security Agency to collect intelligence overseas.
But Snowden says it's the intelligence, the millions and millions of phone numbers and email addresses collected in this country, that prompted him to pilfer an estimated 1.7 million classified documents.
What have you given up?
Bill Harlow served 25 years in the Navy and became the top spokesman for the CIA.
You know, somewhere in some database somewhere, your phone number exists without your name attached to it, without your address attached to it, and it sits in a pile of other phone numbers. And if someday some terrorist from Al-Qaeda calls you up, I think the government and the FBI have a right to know that.
In my view, rather than buying a ticket to Hong Kong, he should have bought a ticket to Washington.
P.J. Crowley is a former Army Air Force B-17 pilot and was also the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. Now he's a professor at George Washington University.
Any whistleblower who calls himself a whistleblower should, in fact, be prepared, you know, to present himself to authorities and accept whatever the consequences of his actions are.
He could easily have gone to the Inspector General of the NSA. He could have gone to members of Congress. What you don't do is to run to Chinese-controlled Hong Kong and to Moscow to hide away. You do your act, and then you take the consequences. He didn't do that.
Melissa Muscala is an assistant professor of philosophy at Catholic University.
You can think, well, what does it really mean to accept the punishment, right? The fact that he was willing to do this means he basically gave up his life as he knew it. He's effectively in exile indefinitely, and who knows what's going to happen to him.
Where is it written that to be a legitimate whistleblower, you have to stand before the firing squad and take the bullets in the chest? Let's face it, this country does not have a great track record when it comes to giving whistleblowers the due that is owed to them for coming forward.
I went through every chain of command that existed, including internal, inspector general.
Snowden has said that he skipped the country because he saw what happened to whistleblower Thomas Drake. Drake was an NSA senior analyst who went to the Baltimore Sun only after he'd gone up the chain of command to complain about a billion-dollar spy program that was later abandoned.
I was put under severe duress. I was surveilled physically and electronically. I was threatened. At one point, the chief prosecutor in April of 2008 said, how would you like to spend the rest of your life in prison, Mr. Drake, unless you cooperate with our investigation? And so they came after me with everything they had.
Ultimately, all charges were dropped, but only after Drake lost his job and mortgaged his home to pay legal bills.
I mean, when you're a whistleblower, you are extremely isolated. The government called me a traitor and a turncoat and a terrorist sympathizer in the New York Times, and that makes you pretty radioactive.
Jesselyn Radak is another whistleblower who got in serious trouble after she went public when she was an ethics advisor for the Justice Department.
I got a call one day asking about the ethical propriety of interrogating the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, without an attorney.
She replied it wasn't ethical or proper, but then she learned that Lind was interrogated without his lawyer and that the interrogation was used as evidence in his trial. She also discovered that her correspondence to the Justice Department had been purged. That was when she resigned and called a reporter. The case collapsed and Lind pled guilty to two relatively minor infractions, although he was given a lengthy sentence.
So I thought the whole ordeal was over at that point. My ordeal had only just begun because I ended up unleashing the full force of the entire executive branch in a really ugly way.
The government brought a criminal case against her, referred her for discipline before the D.C. and Maryland bars, and put her on the no-fly list. Ultimately, the criminal case was dropped, the bar complaint dismissed, and she is no longer on the no-fly list. She says she got through it with the help of her rabbi, and Exodus 22, verse 3, which says, "Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do wrong."
That has been something that has informed my life. It's always there in the background.
The reprisals are really heavier today than they were, you know, 20 years ago.
Lewis Clark heads the Government Accountability Project, which has represented about 5,000 whistleblowers, including Thomas Drake and Edward Snowden. He's a former United Methodist pastor whose father was investigated wrongfully for communist ties by the FBI and himself investigated for his civil rights work.
I'm as patriotic as any person, I believe, in terms of my government. But I also have a faith which says that when your government is wrong, you need to stand up and challenge that.
P.J. Crowley left the State Department after he complained in a speech that Private Bradley Manning had been mistreated. He does not feel the same about Edward Snowden.
What Edward Snowden is basically saying is that I, Edward Snowden, I know what's better for the United States. I can put myself effectively in the role of Congress. I can put myself more effectively in the role of a judge. I don't think that Edward Snowden has the right or the expertise to make those kinds of judgments.
So why then does a slim majority of Americans in a recent poll consider Edward Snowden a hero? Why the rallies in his support?
I'm just outraged, like most people here, at the, you know, the mass surveillance that's going on, and people just don't seem to be upset about it.
People have a right to be concerned about privacy, and I would argue that the information collected on you by Google or Yahoo or Amazon is much, much greater than any exposure you might have from NSA trying to prevent terrorism.
Here in Washington, we still have a political narrative that acts of terrorism are preventable. We had that debate after 9/11. And so if we treat acts of terrorism as failures, then what we're saying to the intelligence communities is you've got to do whatever you got to do.
Have we given up too much of our privacy rights and freedoms in the 12 years since 9/11 in the name of national security?
What do you get by the Snowden revelations? And I acknowledge that the debate is useful. You know, but at what cost? I think we still have to figure that out.
For now, a standoff. Snowden says he won't come home if he's going to be prosecuted, so it's unlikely he'll be coming home anytime soon. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Washington.
It was 1 year ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI shocked the world by announcing his resignation. He was the first pope in the modern era to resign. A year later, the retired pope is said to be in good spirits and at peace with his legacy. His personal secretary, Archbishop Georg Genswein, said Benedict has no regrets about his frequently criticized papacy, and that he considers it his mission to support Pope Francis in prayer. Genswein also said the two enjoy a good relationship and are frequently in touch. The federal government will soon grant the same rights and benefits to gay married couples as it does to heterosexual couples. The new policy announced this week will give same-sex marriages, quote, full and equal recognition to the greatest extent possible under the law. Gay rights groups welcomed the changes, but critics, including the Family Research Council, said the federal government was overstepping its bounds because many states still don't recognize same-sex marriages. The church trial of a prominent United Methodist pastor who performed his son's same-sex wedding has been indefinitely postponed. Reverend Thomas Ogletree, who is the retired dean of the Yale Divinity School, was set to face trial on March 10th for violating church law. But now all parties have said they will pursue a, quote, just resolution before resorting to a trial. Many United Methodists have been calling for an end to such trials. In November, Pennsylvania pastor Frank Schaefer was found guilty and was defrocked for officiating at his son's gay wedding. Finally, Abraham Foxman is retiring. Next year, after 27 years as national director of the Anti-Defamation League. At the ADL, the outspoken Holocaust survivor has fought anti-Semitism and other forms of intolerance. He became one of the country's most prominent Jewish leaders. As a child during World War II, Foxman was separated from his Polish parents, but he was protected, cared for, and baptized by Catholics. The New York Times quoted him this week as having said that the ADL provided me with a platform to deal with the two things that formed my lifetime, the bigotry which almost destroyed me and the human love and compassion which saved me. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website where there's always much more and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more of the worship service at the Church of the Presentation of Our Lord in Amman, Jordan.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.